The information and opinions presented in this ARC Energy Ideas podcast are provided for informational purposes only and are subject to the disclaimer link in the show notes.
This is the ARC Energy Ideas podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas podcast for May 25th. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Welcome back. So we've got a lot to talk about, but how have you been faring now? What has it been?
Over 2 months.
2 months,
and,
yeah.
You know, as you probably know, Calgary Phase 1 opening is today.
Yeah.
They're going to have haircuts and going to the restaurants and bars. Are you hitting the bars later today?
Oh, absolutely. No.
I'm gonna Maybe you need to get the haircut first, Peter.
I'm not ready yet. Haircut, I do need. But, you know, I was thinking about that over the weekend, and I think I'll just have my son cut it again. For me, it's actually more the hassle factor. Like, there's just so many rules and regulations and this and that. You know, I'm not going to pass judgment on them, but... For me, I'm actually quite accustomed and acclimatized to being in quasi-self-isolation in and around my home, and I think I'm going to enjoy the summer at home and do whatever I can from
home. Going to be a hermit?
No, not a hermit, but I'm not ready to get out in the vast public yet. We'll just see how this plays out over the next few weeks.
Playgrounds are opening June 1st. I mean, I think that's a big one for people with kids.
Yeah, for you.
It's been difficult to avoid the playground, you know, with your kid. Take them everywhere. So
are they going to sanitize every time somebody gets on a monkey bar?
Well, they say that it may not actually happen June 1 because there needs to be some inspections done. So I'm really not sure what that means exactly.
Right.
But I don't know what the rules will be. I have no doubt there will be some rules. And hey, I'm probably going to go camping July long weekend. I don't know if
not
to
BC
heard.
Though.
No, Albertans aren't allowed there. But hey, people from British Columbia aren't allowed here.
You just get a can of spray paint and just paint in BC colors your license plate.
Yeah, Alberta campgrounds, provincial.
Yeah.
Open for Albertans.
Well, our campgrounds rate very highly, I think.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I mean, they're going to have 50% capacity. I'm still not quite certain all the rules. I was actually going to look into that. I know they're not going to allow campfires because they're worried that we don't want to start a fire.
Right. Well, that makes sense.
But
it sort of speaks to the number of people that are getting back into cars and RVs. I've heard RV sales are way up. You know, that's going to be the new mode of transportation. And that's something we're going to talk about is whether or not it's the end of oil or not. It doesn't seem to me.
No, I don't think so. So this week, you sent out a vignette. And for those that don't know, the Energy File website, if you sign up for it, is sending out a vignette every week. And the vignette of the week from Peter this week was a picture to an abandoned gasoline pump.
Yeah, this is a photo I took a few years ago. It's on just off Highway 2 by Carstairs. There was this old abandoned gas station. And so one day I just made a special trip with my camera and just started taking pictures of this abandoned gas pumps, actually, just knowing that at some point, you know, there was going to be a story to tell about, quote, the end of oil. And sure enough, here we are. So I pulled out the photo and the vignette, which is in the Energy File collection at energyfile.org. And the title of it is Not Yet Ready to Abandon the Pump. And really the message is that there's a lot of people calling for the end of oil, and we'll talk about those who were here in a minute, but that the scale of our dependency on oil for mobility and for all sorts of other things that we take for granted in life is so big that to call for the end of oil, even in a pandemic, is really premature.
And I think many of our listeners know that Elizabeth May of the Green Party and the Bloc Québécois leader, Yves-François Blanchet, both think so. In the last week or so, they've said that oil and gas is never coming back. Oil and gas is dead.
Well, no, I think that actually, even surprise to me, it's coming back with a lot of vigor, the oil demand, especially in places like China. I mean, you look at, it's already being documented, the traffic congestion, as people reoccupy their cars as personal space that is away from everyone. In other words, self-isolating in your vehicle, not wanting to take other modes of transportation, for example, subways and buses and what have you, airplanes. And so the car and therefore gasoline consumption, and therefore that trickles back into refinery runs. I mean, what are the refinery runs in China? It's pretty...
I don't know. They've been coming back, and we'll talk about that. Actually, there's a lot of signposts that the oil market is rebounding faster than many people thought. So, you know, I think those kind of comments... I mean, the other thing is, we had 70 million barrels a day at probably the lowest point here. Like, that's still a lot of oil. Hardly dead.
When it's hardly dead, I mean, when half the world is in lockdown at the peak of the pandemic intensity, the consumption of oil only goes down by 30%.
Yeah. And it's still 70 million barrels a day. You know, it kind of reminded me of that Monty Python movie, you know, where the guy with the cart picking up the dead bodies, bring out the dead. And then they throw the one guy in the cart that's like, I'm not dead.
There's good indication to believe that the industry was going to be in for a very prolonged downturn, potentially, because we just didn't know how the pandemic was going to play out, although we know that all pandemics end. But, you know, even I didn't expect, as I said earlier, the vigor with which this consumption is coming back. And the behavioral changes are actually, in some ways, regressive to an energy transition.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some of that, because I was actually thinking even all the single-use plastic use is
supposed
to be going up.
Ordering out from restaurants. And
all this protective equipment is like one-time use, throw it away. But before we get to the oil stuff, I did want to just mention, in case many of you missed it, pretty excited to see there's a task force to study the hydrogen economy in Alberta's industrial heartland. They announced it. It's a number of people on this panel, including municipal leaders in the Edmonton area, provincial government people, academics, and the report will be in July. And I really want to have a future podcast on this topic once the report comes out, because I'm pretty excited about it. I really think Alberta has all the pieces to be successful. We've got cheap, abundant natural gas. We've got a concentrated set of users in the heartland who have voluntarily said they want to reduce their emissions, but they also have reason to do it because of the low carbon fuel standard that the federal government plans to roll out. And then on top of that, we have that world's biggest carbon trunk line, which could take the CO2 and inject it, you know, in central Alberta, so it could be zero emission hydrogen.
It's all very exciting. And notwithstanding, I'm the first to say that it's nowhere near the end of oil, I'm also the first to say that there is a need to diversify, and it's an overused word, pivot into other things. And pivoting into hydrogen as another viable energy system just makes a lot of sense. After all, hydrocarbons, the hydro is hydrogen. And that is a desirable part of the hydrocarbon in terms of energy use.
Yeah, and I think the most exciting part is it could really change the narrative of Alberta. We could be leaders in zero carbon economy, and we really need to do something bold. We'll talk about it a bit more, but let's beat Norway as being a leader in a low carbon economy, because they want to divest of oil sands.
Yeah, well, you want to talk about that, because, you know, that's another subject that sort of drives me up the wall, to be honest with you. The notion that Norway is virtuous in all dimensions. I've been there. It's a great place and lovely people, beautiful country. They don't need to say stuff like that.
Yeah, I agree.
It's just ridiculous.
So, you know, for those that have been living in a cave the last few weeks, Norway's Sovereign Wealth Fund announced it would stop investing and it would divest of Canadian Natural Resources, Cenovus, Suncor, and Imperial. Now, we have talked about their divestment before, and it was always said, you know, we want to divest for diversity reasons. We have a lot of value in oil, and if oil price went down, you know, we don't want to be so levered towards oil. But they did say they were going to divest of upstream-only companies and stay with integrated companies. That was their overarching policy. Mm-hmm. So that would make sense to divest of CNRL and Cenovus, but you should stay invested with Suncor and Imperial because they have refining assets, and you would, you know, their general policy was that.
Let's just back up a bit, because I you know, when I hear those sort of very direct comments pointed at Canada and the Canadian oil and gas players, I think, okay, you know, actually when I first heard it, I sort of shrugged my shoulders and said, okay, all right, you know, we already know that they were doing this based on, as you said, our previous podcast, it's almost a year ago. So they're just making that declaration and they only have a half dozen or maybe a dozen companies in their portfolio and they're exiting. So I went to the website and did a little bit of poking around and downloading to find out what their portfolio of upstream oil and gas looks like. So how many companies do you think they own?
Well, it should be zero according to their policy.
Over 300. Okay, we are going to post this. We're going to post this on the website. There are over 300 companies as at the end of 2019, so not very long ago. I'm asking myself, like, why are you singling out companies that have made a declaration that they are going net zero by 2050 in a country that probably has one of the most aggressive climate policies out of many? And you look down the list of the countries that the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund owns, state-owned or otherwise shares in these companies. I mean, I can tell you that their ESG policies are nowhere near virtuous.
Yeah, it's a bit of a double standard, especially because some of these names like Synovus has reduced their emissions by 30%. They have a goal for 30% less by 2030. They have an aspirational net zero. And not all of the other ones have the same thing, but they all have pretty aggressive goals by some respects and have made big improvements. Really, they're just targeting oil sands.
I don't care. You're free to go and invest and divest in whatever you want. Like, why do you have to blow the horn?
Yeah, because they want to make a statement.
Want to make a statement. Yeah. But I mean, I can't, the duplicity of it all. Here's a country that is issuing more offshore licenses, not less. Offshore licenses in the high Arctic, which I do not support at all.
Yep.
And you're telling me this is ESG? And then you're going and pointing fingers at our country with our industry that has made some of the most aggressive declarations in ESG in the world. Like, I don't follow it.
Well, and, you know, there have been many groups that have divested from oil sands, university pension funds, insurances, companies. But I actually find this Norway thing more frustrating. This comes from a country that relies on exports of crude oil.
Yeah.
They produce 1.7 million barrels a day. They, as you say, they continue to invest in new projects. In fact, they just have a massive startup of an offshore field that's going to grow to 470,000 barrels a day. They justify their investment because they're saying, well, we're so low carbon. You know, we're 18 kilograms of CO2 a barrel and our newest project is 1 kilogram of CO2 a barrel.
And we're supposed to cherry pick the best one and forget about all the rest, right?
Yeah.
So let's cherry pick the best in Norway and let's cherry pick the worst of Canada.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, and what about everything in between? I just shake my head and think that there needs to be some sense of honesty if we are going to make any headway in the climate change world. There's 50 shades of green here. There isn't just green Norway and everybody else is black.
Mm-hmm. Well, the sad part is, though, that oil sands has a lot to do. And I don't even know if you can change perception at this point, because it's just, you know, we can get to talk about Joe Biden and his KXL comments last weekend. You know, dirty tar sands, we don't need any of it. I think the only way to get away from this perception is to do something really bold. And that's why I'm excited about the hydrogen. Like, I think, unfortunately, perception can be reality and it's tough to change that. And I think we have to recognize that. But why don't we invest in hydrogen, leapfrog others, and no longer be average? Because, I mean, right now we're saying, well, our best projects are average. We are real leaders. So that's why I'm really excited about this project.
I'm excited about that. I mean, nobody in the business world who wants to sincerely compete says, I'm going to compete by being average. No, you have to be leaders. You have to be proverbially better than the best and all that kind of stuff. And I really felt that our industry was on that path pre-pandemic. I think they'll get back on that path and they can actually extend the path and go into and pivot into sort of the energy systems that are finally showing some promise. You know, historically, they were economically unviable. The hydrogens, the CO2 captures, geothermal, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a very exciting period that we can think about going forward. And you're right, absolutely right. We have to go into it with a mentality that we're going to be better than the best. But do not judge us by what we did 10 years ago.
Yeah, that is all really dated information. And when I said average, by the way, just to be clear, that's on the greenhouse gas emissions. I think we're above average on a lot of other elements of ESG, whether it be social, indigenous groups, local community work. There's a lot of places in the world that can learn a lot from Canada. Okay, well, let's move on to an update on the oil markets. As many of you know, oil prices really moved up. It was averaged under $20 for most of April and the first half of May, but it's been about $33 for the past week or so. And the market is reacting to all these positive signposts. You know, we are talking about the signposts. So some of those being obviously the big OPEC cuts and the fact that Saudi Arabia is even adding more to that. Mm-hmm. The North American production seems to be dropping and we're getting that through looking at the storage data. We're seeing that storage last week was drawn down about 5 million barrels week on week. Before that, we were building. They're still at very high levels, but we're starting to see the tide turn here where we're starting to have a shortage of supply and draw down that storage. So
yeah, I mean, it's what's playing out is a mild form of what you and I talked about on this podcast in the first couple of weeks of the pandemic, when we saw the potential for supply to be cut in excess of demand coming back. Right. I mean, the demand is starting to really come back. And it's going to be very interesting to see, for example, the numbers post Memorial Day weekend, where a lot of Americans hit the street.
Yeah, that's the traditional big driving weekend.
Yeah. And I think that there's almost, again, a surge in driving because people have been pent up so much.
Mm-hmm. Well, almost 40 states have released their lockdowns to some extent. Yeah. So there's a lot of people that have a lot more freedom than they did before.
Yeah.
So, you know, that is showing good signs. I would just caution, though, my concern is on the supply side, not the demand side as much. We have very, very high inventory levels, and we had this 5 million for the week draw. But go back 5 weeks, and we were building at 15 million barrels every week. And if supply starts to come back, because $33 might be a level that, mm-hmm. you know, maybe it doesn't encourage you to invest in new wells, but you would turn on the existing wells, that could quickly reverse here, and we'd be back to hitting the tank tops again.
Yeah, so, we could. I don't dispute that the storage issue is looming, that there is effectively still a glut and it could grow again in the storage tanks. But the market has a tendency to look through the valley. You know, once it gets a sense that the other side of the valley is looking more positive than expected, then you'll start to see the whole price structure go up. And that's what we're seeing mm-hmm. happen over the past certainly week, and especially seeing happen. Actually, I'm quite surprised with the Western Canadian Select price, our heavy oil price here in
right.
Canada.
Yeah, the differentials are like quite
that,
narrow.
That suggests to me that there's a greater demand for that kind of oil in the U.S. than hitherto. What's going on there?
Well, just take a pause. You know, when we're long pipe right now, we have the Enbridge mainline not running full. Enbridge reported in April they ran 400,000 barrels a day less than they had before. And we don't have real-time data on the other pipelines, but I can imagine that there's empty space on them as well. And this would give you an indication, if we were ever long pipe in Western Canada, well, that gives you a world where we have much more narrow differentials. That puts yeah. money in the pockets of Albertans and Alberta producers and Western Canadian producers. So it's just a little viewpoint of what the future would look like if we had excess pipe capacity.
Yeah, I mean, it just reminds me certainly of the many years I've been following the oil markets. Just when you think you have it sort of figured out, it's just complete reversal of fortune. I mean, I don't know how many countless hours of podcast time we spent talking about pipeline constraints and wide differentials, and all of a sudden now we've got a completely reverse situation where there's excess pipeline capacity. Mm-hmm. And actually, if we do have those supply side issues and other of impairments of the supply not coming back as fast as we expect, then we could actually have a circumstance where there is excess pipeline capacity.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's temporary for now, but for sure, if we were to add TMX and a bit more capacity, I mm-hmm. think we could be in a world of long pipe capacity, which would be really good for Western Canada. You know, the other thing that would make you think that, and you were talking about how the market may see through this if there's some short-term supply surge because people mm-hmm. turn on the existing wells, is that U.S. rig count. Like, that is coming off hard.
Yeah.
And that isn't maybe going to affect things this month or next month, but 6 months forward, when there's no capital investment, those big declines that American producers have are going to really kick in. The oil rig count is 237. That's 70% lower than the same time last year.
Yeah.
You know, it was 800.
Yeah.
The same time last year.
And if you don't drill, your production goes down.
Exactly. And that's one thing that the Americans have, that is that they have very high decline rates relative to Canada. Our oil sands doesn't decline so fast, but they have more of that light, tight oil that declines very quickly. We have some of that in Canada too, but it's a much smaller fraction of all of our production. So things are looking good on the oil market side, but let's talk a little bit about that U.S. decline in production. You know, it seems inevitable to me with these rig rates that the U.S. production, you know, if I go forward 18 months, mm-hmm. could be down 3-4 million barrels a day. And there's different outlooks out there.
Yeah.
So, Peter, you wrote an article about the implications of this loss of U.S. production and North American production too, because I think we'll lose some production from Western Canada. It won't be as extreme as that. But you had a lot of interest in that article.
Yeah, we sure did. And sort of pointed out that it's taken $2.2 trillion of capital expenditures, largely drilling, over the course of the last 10 years to grow production off of, I can't remember what
it was. It's almost doubled in 10 years.
It's doubled in 10 years, you know, 8 to 10 million barrels a day incrementally more in North America, dominantly from the U.S. side. Our oil sands and our conventional has contributed as well, but the dominant growth in oil production has come from the U.S. And that has been fueled, if you pardon the pun, by cheap access to investment dollars, to banking and debt, and to the cash flow that resulted from the higher prices and the lowering of costs. If we look at the situation today, the drilling rates have collapsed, as you talked about before. So if you don't drill, the production goes down. you can't drill if you don't have access to capital. Equity was dried up before the pandemic. What bank is going to want to lend after this incident? And cash flow, even at $50, is unlikely to generate enough to create enough drilling to offset the declines. And in fact, any extra cash flow when we get back to $50 is just going to go back to healing the balance sheets and the financial circumstance of the industry before you go back to drilling.
Or increasing those dividends, which have been cut, you know, more money back to shareholders. Yeah, you think about it, like if you go from 13 million barrels a day in the U.S. to, you know, different estimates, maybe 10, 9, even 8 million barrels a day, at the same price, you just generate way less money. Right. And at the same time, if the debt holders want the money and the shareholders want the money, then there's going to be less going into the ground. So it's really hard to see how the U.S. would start to grow again unless we got very high prices.
So this is the immediate implication that people are talking about is that it's going to be very difficult to grow it back to where it was before. But that has much broader implications because, as I pointed out in the article, that in that last 10 years, we have in North America, Canada plus US, become largely energy independent for oil. In other words, we've pushed out all the imports that has come from the other parts of the world. That has had multiple benefits, including greater political stability, employment, keeping the cash flow within the continent, and just numerous benefits. And if you think about the 10 million, I'm going to use that number as what we have grown it to with the $2.2 trillion, that if we're going to lose, what, three, four? It's like you're rewinding the clock back to times where we were dependent upon countries like the Saudis, the Russians, and others that we did not want to give our valuable dollars away to, and that we make our energy circumstance more unstable at a time when we're deglobalizing.
Yeah, like to put it in perspective, U.S. and Canada have grown to make up 80% of U.S. petroleum consumption.
Yep.
A decade ago, that was 40%. Yep. So now all that money that was being paid to all these foreign countries is being paid to Americans and Canadians. Now, the U.S. has really been emboldened by this growth in their energy production, and they've really changed their foreign policy. So, for example, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo at CERAWeek in March of 2019 said that their newfound shale oil and natural gas abundance would strengthen our hand in foreign policy. And the Trump's administration called it their energy dominance agenda. And you have to think, you know, if they hadn't had this growth, would have they put sanctions on Venezuela, Iran, and Russia as they did?
Oh, yeah.
No, I don't think they would have.
Huge geopolitical implications, because if you follow the narrative over the last 15 years, in the eras leading up to the peak of the peak oil on the supply side era, say circa 2007, the concern was all about energy dependency. And then as the shale oil and the oil sands contributed to gradually a greater sense of more domestic production, we went to a narrative of energy independence. And then that shifted to energy dominance, as the United States actually became net exporters of natural gas with the LNG terminals and all sorts of petroleum products. Now we're going to rewind the clock back, in my opinion, to not energy dominance, but back to energy slight independence, maybe, to dependency. We'll see what happens.
We'll see, for sure there'll be more dependency.
We don't know how much is going to be impaired and then how much we're going to have to import again from the other side of the world.
Well, that gap, as we just said, without any government intervention, there's no way I could see that the U.S. will grow again unless prices go very high, but assuming prices kind of get back to where we've been the last 5 years. And so they are going to have to fill that in with more foreign oil imports and, you know, from other places overseas that may not be the kind of countries they want to be partners with. KXL made big news as Joe Biden, the Democratic candidate for president, says he will cancel KXL. He's been against it since the beginning. It's tar sands and we don't need it. The fact that it is a very, very high pollutant. Well, we just talked about how that's misinformation. But, you know, when he gets, if he were to be elected and he gets into that job, I'm not sure this is going to be his biggest issue. And, you know, he may not be thinking about it, but this gap and the dependence on foreign oil from the Middle East and all the costs and headaches associated with that, you know, maybe he'll look differently at KXL, which is going to strengthen continental energy security.
It is, especially on the heavy oil side, because the United States uses all sorts of oils, light, medium, heavy, heavy dominantly comes from Canada now. And to curtail that at a time when energy dependency is coming back doesn't strike me as being something that has been carefully thought through. We shall see. I mean, we all know this stuff is very political. He has to play to the base, et cetera, et cetera. We all understand politics.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, but what a politician says this early in that campaign isn't necessarily a priority when they get in.
But it's interesting that memories are short, because it was only a dozen years ago where the dominant issue relevant to oil was not climate change, it was energy security. And there was troops in Iraq. Mm-hmm. And all the
how about the biofuels mandate? You know, that was, I think, put in more for energy security reasons than greenhouse gas emissions.
George W. Bush, he put that biofuels mandate in because it was an energy security issue. And we haven't had to talk about energy security for at least a decade. And I think it's coming back, not today, not tomorrow. But as you alluded to, Jackie, the drilling today will affect the circumstance about 12 months from now.
Yeah, for sure. 12, 18 months from now, you're going to see a massive drop, and it's going to not be something you can reverse. I mean, today's shut-ins, sure, the price comes back, we turn the tap on. You can't replace that capital investment overnight. And as I said, we both said, you know, there isn't capital to get it going again. Yeah. It's kind of like an engine. Once it's got momentum, it can keep going. But now it's going to go to a slower level, and you can't really get it to speed up again.
So we'll see what the policy implications are. First of all, we have to see what the scale of the impairments are going to be, but there's a whole number of policy implications, which we won't let on to on this podcast because we want to save something for later things to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, I think we should talk about what could incent more domestic production. Is there something government can even do here? What does it mean for the green agenda? I mean, there's a whole series of issues.
Yeah, and it's not all negative, by the way, for the green agenda, and we'll talk about that.
Yeah. There's also implications for natural gas. You know, like if we're going to have less oil production in the U.S., what does that mean for natural gas?
Right.
Can we assume natural gas prices are going to be high? Good. Well, I think that wraps up our podcast for this week.
Oh, yeah. Lots to talk about. And really, the next 3-4 weeks, again, are going to be fairly pivotal in understanding how the opening up of the lockdown is going to affect the way we live, work, play, whether or not we're going to have another second wave, as they're calling it. And all of that, of course, has implications to our energy consumption.
All right. We'll be back to give you those signposts. Thanks for joining. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate us on the app that you listen to and tell someone else about us.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.